Hello and welcome to the DebtWired podcast. I'm your host, Johannes Koch, senior reporter at DebtWire. I'm pleased to have Hannah Gates with me from law firm Allen & Overy. Hannah specializes in lender-side domestic and cross-border leverage finance transactions across the credit spectrum. Her practice covers acquisition and other event-driven finance across a wide range of capital structures. Her extensive experience of private credit transactions makes her ideally placed to advise clients on transactions where potential financing options require knowledge of both the syndicated and private debt markets. Hi, Hannah. Thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're going to look at the convergence of private credit and banks today and what developments we are seeing and what we may expect to see. How is private credit more bank-like and vice versa? Ultimately, what are the risks, potential limitations, but also the opportunities within this convergence of the two lending practices? So let's start with the obvious question to set the stage. In what way are we seeing private credit funds behaving more like banks?
I think this is sort of the question of private credit right now. It's hugely topical. We're in the middle of a convergence of lending markets. So rather than thinking, you know, there's a bond market and a bank market and then a private debt market, we're actually now thinking there's just one market and it draws elements from all three. It draws elements from large cap, mid cap, and it's really more becoming a question about how you think about each individual credit and each individual lending institution and their source of funds to build a deal that sort of has the right terms, both for the investment side and then also the corporate that's receiving the funds. So it's a lot more dynamic and kind of mixed up as a market. It's a really interesting time. So to answer the question a bit more directly, how are we seeing funds behave more like banks? I think we're seeing an increase in secondary. We're seeing an increase in sort of club deals or more than club, kind of 16, 17 funds in the original deal, and then them intending to kind of warehouse and sell on to more funds. So you end up with what looks almost like a syndicated deal, but in the private debt market. And as a result of that, terms borrowed from one market to the other. We're seeing questions as to whether people should be charging arranger fees and kind of what that means from both a tax and a regulatory perspective. So a lot of difference between funds as to what they feel they can and can't do. And I think we're seeing funds invest more in building relationships across the kind of market to make sure that they can offer the same range of terms as a bank. So it used to be that if you were doing a private debt deal, they could do unitranche, right? But probably not source an RCF, whereas now some can do kind of light touch RCF-like products. You've got delayed draw term loans and all sorts. And others have built JVs, relationships with banks, so that they can directly source the RCF. Same with hedging products. So I think those are the main ways we're seeing funds make sure that they can effectively offer the same range of products as banks.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Just on that point of light touch, sort of undrawn facilities, we've been seeing, I guess, private credit funds using delayed draw term loans as well as a way to, you know, provide that kind of financing. Are you seeing that as well? What is your take on that particular mechanism?
Definitely. I think we've now got a lot of structures where there's a unitranche and a delayed draw term loan. That's becoming quite common. And in a lot of those structures, actually, there's no need for a revolver, depending on the credit, right? So it may well be that if the reason they wanted a revolver was just for, you know, future M&A, bolt-on acquisitions, et cetera, they can do that with a delayed draw. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of deals where that's a feature. And as I say, where there's an RCF, often there's either a JV relationship there that the fund can offer, or they can offer like a bridge to RCF, so an extra slice of delayed draw term loan that then gets paid down dollar for dollar when you enter into an RCF or canceled down dollar for dollar.
That's interesting. I mean, as well, I'm guessing the RCF was sort of the mainstay for banks in your more unitranche-driven world. What are they doing conversely? What are they doing, or how are banks behaving more like credit funds, or what are they doing to counter private credit's move onto their territory?
There is a nervousness there or a need to be agile. We are seeing a lot more club deals, and actually club deals that then have both funds and banks in them, to my point about it being sort of one broad market now, where you just have to understand the different credit pools rather than thinking of it as a bank market and a private debt market. So a lot more club deals. We're seeing more focus on an arranger role being offered. I've done a couple of deals where there's a kind of arranger to private debt solution role offered, particularly if you've got a P2P or something like that, where there are reasons to be going to one bank, right? Because you've got your sort of limitations on how many people can be in the tent from an information perspective. And needs for kind of cash confirms, et cetera. We're also seeing, as well as sort of club deals, we're seeing a lot more flexibility on what banks are willing to offer. So increasingly, you might have deals where there's Call Pro instead of an ECF sweep, for example, right? Like traditionally, because private debt has an investor that wants to be invested as such, right? There's more parity between the person investing or the institution investing in the fund, the LP, and then the deployment. So they've got a strategy, it's got a sort of life cycle. And because of that, when the fund invests, they want to know that that investment is for a fixed period of time and have a view on the return, right? So usually with fund lending, private debt lending, you'd have a non-call period. The reverse is true of sort of an investment bank strategy, where it's a lot of it is actually about the initial return, right? The upfront fee and then selling on. And the investors are actually looking at getting a decent return over time, but shorter time periods, right? Because it's paper that they're trading. So if you've got profits coming in, excess profit, right? You're going to have an ECF sweep usually. So any extra profit generated in a year after a buffer goes to pay down the debt. That will be more bank style. We're seeing now bank deals where there's no ECF sweep, but instead they've got the call protection, and vice versa for some fund deals, right? Where you could actually have the pay down. So, or at least where you don't have block on pay down, right? A traditional fund position would be you have voluntary prepayments, mandatory prepayments, but the fund can choose to waive them, again, to the point of them wanting to be invested for the time period that they expected to be invested for, right? So a lot more flexibility on both sides. And every deal, it's kind of about just figuring out what people can live with, what people are trying to achieve with their investment.
I mean, this sounds like a greater level of complexity. Wasn't the idea of private debt to be somewhat more flexible, but also speed of execution? I mean, if you talk about club deals, it's very bank-like. Just some idea on what you make of that.
Yeah, I think people understand the market and have a view of what they can do. So actually, each product, each deal is a bit more different and bespoke, but agreeing terms is very swift. I've got one deal today where we were instructed yesterday and we're going to sign by next Wednesday. The speed is still there, but it's just more a question of at the beginning of each deal, talking to each of the different lenders and really saying, you know, what have you been discussing with the company in terms of what you can offer and what everybody wants to get out of this investment? So it's not impacted on speed. We just have to be a bit more agile.
Coming on to a slightly different topic, I mean, how is private credit managing this transition? I mean, what risks and opportunities does this present for the funds themselves, the LPs you've touched on briefly, and the companies they support?
Yeah, I think a dynamic market is interesting for everyone, but maybe favors in some ways larger institutions. So because, you know, you've now got this market where actually, it's not sort of three sets of terms, you know, bond terms, bank terms, private debt terms, and people can choose, you know, in a very binary way between one set of terms and the pricing that comes with it or another set of terms and the pricing that comes with it. It's now a lot more dynamic, right? So there's a more complex matrix of what terms you can get for what pricing. The result of that is if you've got a bunch of different institutions that are all only offering one of those products, it becomes really hard for a sponsor or a corporate to you know, compare like for like and figure out what the best match is going to be for them. So we're seeing a lot of interest in institutions that can provide at least two, if not three, of the kind of different traditional products. So, I mean, you'll have seen in the news, you know, the new JPM team that sits within the investment bank that does more private debt solutions. You've also got a lot of funds that now have sort of two strategies, right? One which is take and hold investing, and one which is more their warehousing practice, right? Where they, if they invest out of that part of the fund, they're planning to sell it on. So they can offer something that's more like a syndicated deal in terms and pricing and something that's more like private debt. I think those institutions are kind of best placed and people that have good relationships across institutions so they can work together and present them as a, you know, a suite of alternatives. Similarly, we're seeing a lot more focus on the role that debt advisors or law firms can play in terms of bringing different offerings together and presenting them as a package to the sponsor or corporate.
I guess the question then is, I mean, how are banks handling private debt coming in and providing additional terms and ancillary facilities? Means they're basically also setting up as a one-stop shop. Does that mean they're rivaling private credit in many respects? And what are they doing to mitigate the challenges as they face sort of private credit on the other side?
Yeah, I think right now private credit is still booming in terms of, as you say, speed of execution. You know, those parts of the market haven't moved as quickly as they could, right? So I do think, you know, banks are still in some ways in this market in a challenger position. They, you know, continue to focus on making sure that they can provide, as I say, a range of terms, speed of execution. But increasingly, I think it's about recognizing that they're not going to necessarily be playing the underwriter and arranger role in as many circumstances as previous, and focusing therefore on, you know, club deals or deals where the club is not just debt funds, but also has banks in it. We're seeing a lot more of that, more kind of like the continental European approach to bank lending coming back to London.
And I guess my final question is more around what are the sort of challenges or dangers we might see with this? I mean, there's been some critique of private credit, given that it is private, so there's not as much transparency behind it. Banks live in a different world when it comes to that. Are funds and banks stepping into some sort of a regulatory quagmire?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point, right? Because the historic argument for private debt was that it doesn't need regulation because you have close alignment between the investor risk appetite and the deployment of the funds. So your LPA agreements would clearly spell out what kind of debt you're investing in, you know, what kind of corporate you're investing in a lot of granularity, right? So you didn't have a range of performing, non-performing, or different jurisdictions. You'll have seen the news on Friday that a lot of the Barings senior team resigned, and there's a question as to whether there's, you know, key man undertakings in a lot of their LPAs that might be triggered, right? So historically, you've got this very close alignment between the investor giving their money to the fund manager and then knowing how it's going to be deployed. So you don't need to regulate that particularly closely because everybody knows the risks quite well. There's, you know, a lot of alignment between the risk taken and the investor. Increasingly, we're seeing both the arranger role being played, which is a more regulated role, and we're also seeing multi-strat funds or funds with a lot wider purpose, because in the pandemic, people started to realize that actually opportunities were coming up that certain pools of capital couldn't invest in because they didn't look like what they thought opportunities would look like when they were doing their fundraising. So they had all these pools of capital that didn't quite match the opportunities that were available. And it's moved a lot more to therefore having these multi-strat funds. That's a good thing. But as you move to that, it starts looking a little bit more like bank lending, right? Where you've got a lot of discretion over how you're deploying, where you're doing an arranger role, making something that, you know, start thinking about benchmarking and selling to the market and all those kind of traditionally syndicated thought processes. I've had a deal where somebody asked me if we could have flex on it. And I was like, oh, wrong market. So as that all kind of converges and we really start having to think about one market as a whole, I think it's inevitable that regulators at least are looking at the market. We know that they're looking at the market, right? A lot of our clients are focused on that. I'm the wrong person to talk to it in any detail, but my regulatory colleagues are all over this and kind of aware of and liaising with, from an information perspective or kind of education perspective, the different regulators who are looking at this. So I think that's what funds need to be doing, right? Is making sure that they are staying ahead of future regulation. It's not a quagmire as such. It's just a market in flux.
Fantastic. I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you for being on the show and your insights, Hannah.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To our audience, I'd also like to thank you for listening. And please visit iTunes or Spotify for more DebtWired podcasts.